各位好，这里是香港中文大学出版社的播客《不羁不随》，我是值班编辑陈田。本期播客的主题呢，是美国的一位传奇历史学家列文森。大家可能听说过有一个很厉害的学术大奖，叫做列文森奖，可能会在一些学术书的推荐腰封上看到这个奖。但是列文森是谁呢？为什么他很重要？为什么他会以奖的形式一年又一年的出现呢？他到底以什么样的方式影响了怎么样的一代或者是几代学者呢？这一期的形式会比较特别，因为我们是用同样的一组问题，以线下或者线上的方式访问了四位美国学界非常资深的教授，包括加州大学圣地亚哥分校的周希瑞教授，加州大学伯克利分校的叶文新教授，哈佛大学欧立德教授，和我们最新出版的列文森文集的主编华盛顿大学的董岳教授。在我们的访谈中呢，有很多深刻、新鲜、生动、回味悠长的内容，可以带领我们从不同的角度重新理解和走进这位如雷贯耳但敬而远之的大师列文森。而且呢，如果把四段访谈放在一起对比着听，还能发现新的火花。比如说列文森小组的故事，一个持续十几年的故事，可能还要再持续几十年。再比如周希瑞老师的背叛师门对照欧立德老师的背叛师门。为了方便大家收听，我是把提问的部分做了重新的录制作为串联的线索，但是四位老师的回答就还是保留了原始的形态，有中文也有英文，有的时候老师们是一会儿中文一会儿英文。这期呢，从语言到内容都是有些挑战的，但我相信如果能坚持听完还是会有所收获，希望大家喜欢。第一组问题会围绕个人的回忆展开，首先请叶文新老师，您还记不记得最早是什么时候开始读列文森？
就是我大概是从大学的时候就开始读列文森，那么那个时候呢，从那个时候开始就觉得他难读难懂，可是他最吸引人的是他的句法，也就是说他这个表述的方式，当他把这个主语跟宾语或者是副词跟动词加以颠倒之后，它同一个句子它可以变化出不同的诠释的方案，所以我那个时候就觉得这人使用文字有它的独到的地方。那么就跟我们平常读的这种史学书平铺直叙的方式有所不同，所以呢我那个时候呢就开始对它产生兴趣。那么后来呢，读研究所呢是在伯克利读的。那么在伯克利读研究所，那正是列文森当年教书的地方。我在伯克利做学生的时候，我的老师辈有许多当年认识他的人，所以呢，他们也就谈一些关于他的思维的方式、他的意识。那么我也觉得非常的有趣。总之呢，总体说起来，我读列文森大概前前后后断断续续，就是有时读有时不读，前前后后可以说从大学到现在已经读了三四十年。那我必须说呢，在不同的时候不同的语境之下，我读出不同的东西来。当年开始读的时候，那是完全在这个西方论述中国近现代史这个汉学的语境之外，所以我是把它当作一本英文书来读。那么到后来呢，尤其是最近一二十年，那么就可以发现这个时候读列文森跟当年有很多的对比，有很多的反差。譬如说现在我处的是他当年的工作环境，那么现在我们所处的不是1960年代，1960年代是冷战的巅峰时代，今天呢我们所处的完全是不一样的时候。当年他写书，中国对他是封闭的，他无论在外头说什么中国如此这般什么的， 没有跟中国读者以及中国学者对话的机会。所以无论他怎么说呢，是他的一种从外而内的一个独白，而不是一个对话的产品。那么他呢，其实也很有这个自觉，他自己认识到，他说他是一个彻头彻尾的西方人，他完全从西方的文史素养、文史哲的素养，从这个角度来看中国。所以他看的中国，我们今天反过头来去阅读它，这里头有陌生的成分。可是因为他提出来的方式、提问的方式，其实呢，有些时候是这个，正是因为他是局外人，有些大的问题、大的命题，当局者迷，而像他呢，是在局外的人，反而能够一语道破。或者是说这是核心命题之所在，或者是说从知识的角度上来看，这是最有趣的问题。所以从这个意义上来看呢，列文森已经过了五六十年，已经过了六十多年，可是他的著作仍然有相当的启发性，很可能是因为就是以他的眼光，他所提出来的一些关于二十世纪中国近现代史，尤其是思想方面的一些大的命题，这些问题仍然存在。可是我们今天呢，回答的方式或者思考的方式是有所不同的，所以我觉得仍然是值得读的。
欧立德老师，您对于自己早年的列文森阅读史有什么样的回忆呢？
So I first read Levinson as a graduate student at Yale when I was studying with Jonathan Spence, and we read Confucian China and Its Modern Fate. I'm not sure how much of that necessarily understood at the time, but everybody knew it was a big book. It was an important book. You had to read it, so we read it. And the year after that, I ended up actually at Berkeley.For my PhD with Fred Wakeman, Wei Fei Te. And in my first year there, I read the Liang Qichao and the Mind of Modern China book. And it made a huge impression on me at the time. I think partly because I was at Berkeley studying with Levinson's student, Wakeman.But also because many of the teachers I had in Japanese history and in Russian history and in other fields, they all knew Levinson. I was there in 84 and Levinson drowned in 1969. Everyone still remembered Levinson really, really well. You know, to me as a graduate student then 15 years ago, 1969 seemed like a long, long time before. But, you know, looking back at it now, it's 2023. 15 years ago was only 2008. I remember 2008.Pretty well. It doesn't seem like such a long time ago. So actually, looking back at it now, I can understand why people were still talking about him so much. They would retell his old jokes. I mean, it was like he was still kind of walking the hallways, even though he was long gone. He was still a presence in the department. And I read this Liang Qichao book, which I still think is brilliant.And I read it and I was left with this feeling of tremendous sadness. You know, he should still have been alive in 1984. He would have been my age now, okay? And he was gone. He'd been gone a long time. And I just felt so, so sad about it. I wrote a letter to his widow, to Rosemary Levinson. I got her address from Professor Wakeman and I wrote her a note to say I'd read her husband's book and it was so fantastic. You know, to let her know how great I thought it was. And she was extremely kind and she wrote me back and we arranged to meet. I visited her in her house, saw some of the things that the Levinsons had collected when they had been living in Hong Kong. And then, and she took me to dinner once or twice, which again, as a graduate student, I had no money. So a nice dinner out was a big deal. And it was a very sweet thing of Mrs. Levinson to do. So I still remember how much I appreciated that. So there was a kind of a connection there still with Levinson, which made it really hard then when I went back and I had been working on a seminar paper on the Ilao, the Qing loyalists in the early Republican period. And I was trying to understand this whole transition between Imperial China and Republican China. And so I went back to Confucian China and its modern fate and read it a second time. And there were some points in there that I didn't agree with, or that I thought maybe Levinson hadn't gotten quite right. And I felt terrible about thinking critically of such a great scholar, my teacher's teacher. How, you know, who was I, you know, just a know-nothing beginning graduate student, who was I to have ideas critical of the great Joseph Levinson? And I went to Professor Wakeman. I said, Professor Wakeman, I'm not sure how to tell you this, but I just feel terrible. I'm having a really hard time here. I just don't agree with what Joe Levinson wrote here. And he smiled and he said, you know, that's actually perfectly normal. You should disagree with your teachers. That's the whole point. And you shouldn't, don't feel guilty. Just go ahead and write what you think and make your arguments and then it'll all be fine, which of course is great advice. It's the advice I give to my own students. I mention it just as an indication of the way, the kind of reverence that I and I think many others, including Fred himself, Fred Wakeman himself, of course, adored his teacher. But, you know, teachers' ideas are meant to be worked with and not just held at a distance. They're to be engaged with and thought through and kept alive that way, through conversation, through dialogue. So that was my first kind of real intellectual encounter with Levinson. It was very fruitful, and you know, later years I've gone back again and looked through my notes and you know, rereading parts of Confucian China, and I can see how in so many ways a lot of what I've written in books and articles has been shaped by the ideas that I first came across in Levinson's work.
周希瑞老师, 您是列文森亲自带过的学生。 可是最早您为什么会从哈佛跑去伯克利念博士呢？另外还有一个我个人比较好奇的问题，列文森的儿子托马斯在给列文森文集写的序里边提到一个很有意思的细节，就是列文森当年在他伯克利的办公室门口摆了一个大虎头，经常有人被这个虎头给绊倒。您还记不记得您一开始有被他绊过吗？
I didn't trip. To be honest, I think I have a recollection of it, but I'm not sure. I would say this. I, of course, was an undergraduate at Harvard, and I studied with Fairbank, who is always recognized as sort of the dean of Chinese studies in the United States. But after several years of listening to Fairbank's lectures and meeting with him and so on, I'm not sure I'm going to learn anything new here if I keep studying with Fairbank. Fairbank was a very impressive man and very smart and very intellectual, but he had a certain theme and the students were all going to follow that theme. Now, I grew up in the United States, in California. My home is in California, so not very far from Berkeley. So one vacation, I must have written to, because you didn't telephone in those days, and certainly there was no email. This would have been the early 1960s. And I contacted Levinson, and I made an appointment to come and see him. And so that was the first time that I met Levinson. He was just an extremely impressive figure. And I thought, I can really learn something from this. I mean, he's running circles around me and the things that he's saying and the questions he's asking, the way he's talking about China. And this was just very exciting. I had read Levinson's first book, the book about Liang Qichao, as an undergraduate. So I already knew something about him from the book. To put that together with now meeting the person, I just thought, this is where I want to study. So I went to Berkeley to study with Levinson, and I took courses with him. He was a very soft-spoken, gentle, but also extremely open-minded person. Levinson was an intellectual historian, and I knew that I was not going to do intellectual history. That was not where my strength lay. And so I wasn't going to follow that, but that didn't matter to him. Very few of his students actually were in intellectual history. He wasn't looking for that. He was looking for students who somehow he saw promise. I mean, I have no idea why he saw any promise in me, but I was just another student who's coming in to bother him in his office hours or something. So that he admitted me into the program, and I went there to study with Levinson. He would never push you to do a certain project or to have a certain standpoint or viewpoint or argument or something, but he would always ask very gently, very quietly in his manner, these very precise questions. He was a man of few words, but very precise words. I always told my students, you have to read Levinson. This is not an easy book, but you have to read it. And as Dong Yue, as well as others, told me, and they probably have told you, you know, their first experience reading Levinson is, oh my God, I have no idea what he's talking about. This is just much too complicated. You know, I think over time, she, as well as many others, began to realize that there's real depth here.
周希瑞老师在访谈里边提到了他让所有的学生包括董岳老师在内都必须要读列文森，而且是在刚一入门的时候。有意思的是，其实董岳老师也跟我提过这件事情，也提到了他第一次读列文森的时候有多么的困惑。然而这种困惑在他此后的学术生命里边留下了非常长久的非常深刻的烙印。那接下来是董老师的回忆。
最早接触列文森的时候是我在大概是90年代初，应该是91年92年这个样子吧，就是我刚刚开始读博士的时候，在周希瑞教授的博士生研讨班上，那他就让我们读《儒家中国及其现代命运》这本书。但是那个时候因为刚刚到美国时间还不是很长，而且呢刚刚入那个领域，所以对这个领域的历史和很多东西其实都不是很熟悉。我记得非常清楚，那天就是上课的时候讨论这本书，然后周希瑞教授就最后问我说，董岳你怎么看？然后我特别清楚的记得我自己当时的回答，我说我没读懂。我就特别明诚实的跟他说我没读懂。那么确实是没读懂，但是呢也留下了非常深的印象。为什么呢？就是他很让人震撼，一下子就觉得说这本书跟所有其他读过的书关于中国的书都不一样。他的英文呢，当时自己英文水平很差了，但是还是能够感受到他的那种节奏，他的那种律动，他的那种美。然后从思想上来讲的话呢，就是他的那种广泛，你从音乐到绘画，什么从德国的哲学，然后到从这个朱熹到蔡元培，他的那种就是那种纵横辟阔，那种恢宏，那种气氛是感觉得到的。而且他的那种人文的关怀，就是他有一种感情的东西在里面。所以当时呢是没读懂，但是被震到了，所以就成了自己心里面的一个，你因为你如果一个东西你感觉它很不同，这是一个很了不起的东西，但是我没有搞懂，你可以说是一个心里的一个结，永远就是忘不掉，我肯定还是要回来再读，就是这样成了这样一个感受。所以这是最初接触到列文森那个时候留下的一个印象。
其实很有意思的一点就是，您刚刚进入学界之初，就是可能还没有完全开展学术生涯的时候，就碰到这么一个非常震撼的像高山仰止一样的一个学问在那里。我觉得这个是还蛮迷人的一件事情，因为好多现在的学生可能进入学界都是开始很技术性的做一个老师指定的题目。
对，就是不懂，不 不懂，但是呢就是让人非常的好奇，就好像让你有一个习惯性的这个思维的这个过程，你觉得说什么这个问题应该是这样走的，但是哎，有人跟你说曾经有这样一个人，他是这样想的，然后在这个整个这个中国历史这个领域里面，在我们都觉得说是他应该是一路这样过来的，但是曾经有这么一个人，他不是这样的，他有一个另外一个想法，甚至可以说跟过去这个路径是有一点点格格不入的，很特别，但是这个人不在了，所以就是留下了一种震撼，有一些困惑，然后有一些好奇。那我后来在做我的博士论文和第一本书，就是《民国北京城》这本书的时候呢，其实我是引用了列文森的，我那时候也回去读了，这是二读列文森。这个二读列文森呢，可以说是读到了一些东西，但是呢，我想我这个二读列文森可能跟领域里面很多人的那个读法是比较接近的，就是我们会去看到列文森的那著作当中某一部分我们觉得有用的东西，像我就是去看他的那个博物馆画，然后去看他关于这个历史碎片啊什么这样一些的这个讨论。我觉得我对他这个问题的理解呢，就是不能说我理解错了，在民国北京城这本书里面对列文森的理解，现在回头再看重新整体的读过他以后，那个理解不能说错了，但是呢确实也只是去看了那一部分而已。那大部分人其实读列文森的时候，不管是在过去的这几十年里还是在今天，常常就是这样子。那博物馆画呢是他被引用的最多的一部分，但是这次重新的把他整个的这个大的一套东西全部读下来的话，就会意识到说那真的只是很小的一部分。
那您刚刚提到就是有一个就是全面的完整的去重读列文森的这么一个起点，那我想好像是在您已经正式的进入学术行业之后，
对，
很长一段时间之后，那您是大概是什么时候在什么样的契机下去读，然后想法发生了什么样的转变？
对，这个大概是进入学界十年以后吧，大概是这样一个时间，大概是在2007年到2008年这个样子。那个时候呢，中国历史学界现代近现代史学界吧，好像有一个怎么说呢，有一个安静下来的那样一段时间，因为各种理论的热潮好像就有点过去。那么在那样一个时刻呢，你就会觉得说不太知道这个领域在干什么，这个领域在往哪里走，什么样子东西是有意义的，所以就会想到那句话说，你要想知道往哪里走，先看看从哪里来，对吧？所以我就当时就有一个想法说，哦，我去看一看这个领域从哪里来。那么也不想所有的东西都重新回去读，对吧？所以那个时候呢，去读了这个 Benjamin Schwartz 的东西，严复复国。然后呢，后来就想去读列文森，因为当年就留下了一个心结，因为当年没有读懂，所以从个人的角度来讲和从领域的角度来讲，就都是有这样一个动机。所以是有一年的夏天，大概是2007年的夏天，我想我用这个暑假我来重读列文森。然后有的时候这个学术的生产呢，就是你要说是一种很巧合的东西，也是很巧合的东西。那个时候刚好就跟帮我们这次翻译那个犹太身份的选择张平教授，我就跟张平教授其实是随便聊天。那么他是做犹太学的学者，他在翻译塔木德，我就跟他讲起列文森。然后呢，就张平就有一些，因为他是做犹太学的，犹太教研究的，那他就有一些非常在我听来就是非常新奇，从来没有听到过也没有想到过的一些想法，这就更促使我去再去重新阅读列文森。有的时候真的就是一种机缘，你不知道为什么这些事情会同时在那个时候发生，应该是2008年的夏天吧，在韩国，就是叶文新教授跟韩国的一个大学和研究所一起办了一个关于中国近现代的一个研讨会。那么这个研讨会上呢，有一个主题就是重读经典。那重读经典的话，刚好我在重读列文森，所以我就在那个上面就是讲了重读列文森。那个时候我才发现我不是唯一一个这样做的人， 因为叶文新教授、欧立德教授还有齐木石、白建明，他们有一些人他们已经也在重读列文森，而且他们已经就是聚过讨论过。所以后来因为我就做了这个2008年的时候做了这个研究，他们就说哎，我们其实也在重读列文森，所以呢就他们也就邀请我也去加入他们，这个就成了这个后来重读真的认真的系统的重读列文森，就变成了不是一个人的事情，变成了一种真的是很不同背景的学者之间的交流。因为比如说像张平教授，他不是做中国研究的，但是呢没有他的那些视角的话，很多问题其实我也是想不通的，我不会想到的。嗯，就比如说他关于这个，我们讨论过关于说这个列文森对于犹太文化、犹太历史和犹太教的理解跟他对中国的理解之间是什么关系，他对传统的看法这些东西是从哪里来的。那么我去看了列文森档案，那列文森档案在 UC Berkeley 的图书馆里面是有几箱子的，我现在常常脑子里还会想起他那些档案当中一些资料的那个就是那个视觉的那种东西，也是很让人觉得很有意思，但是我觉得我还是不懂。就是他会比如说有一些几乎就是一张白纸哈，这张白纸上没有别的东西，这张白纸上就一个词，然后有一条线，比如说会有一条线，然后你再看见一张白纸上面又是一个词，我不知道他在做什么，但是这个是他思考的过程，对吧？但是呢在这个档案里面我后来发现的一个事情，就是列文森他在进行关于中国的思考的时候，他不是单独的在思考中国，那么这个可能是列文森最大的一个特点。而他不是单独的思考中国，他也不是把中国直接简单的跟西方做一个二维的对照，或者说比较，或者是在这个关联当中进行思考，他至少还有一个第三维，就是他个人关于犹太身份认同、犹太历史、犹太文化、犹太宗教这样的一个思考。那么后来在重读的时候，我想到这个问题，其实三维都还不止，他还会去看到日本历史，去看到中亚的历史，去看到俄国的历史。
您刚刚提到了列文森小组，哎，这刚好就是我很感兴趣的一个问题。因为您跟叶文新、欧立德、黄乐嫣、白杰明、齐木石几位老师一起为列文森文集写了一篇几万字的导读。而在写导读之前，我听说就是小组共同的阅读和共同讨论已经持续了十几年。我想如果我们要讲述一个更大的列文森故事，除了他本人，除了他家庭的故事，那列文森小组也是一条必不可少的线索。我好奇的点是，为什么会有这么一组人，都是学界的中间，做了这么多年的研究，但是每一年还要回到列文森去？哎，这点让我觉得非常的奇妙。可不可以请您大概为我们介绍一下？
叶文新教授和欧立德教授可能可以告诉你更多，他们早一些的，就是在我加入的时候，其实他们已经聚过一次，就是而且在一个研讨会上曾经发表过一次，做过一次讨论，所以那个时候是我加入进去的。学者有一种这样的互动是非常难得的一件事情，而且它确实可以碰撞出一些东西来。还有就是在这样一个多年的这样一种讨论当中，你会发展出一种信任，那么在这种信任的情况下呢，你不同的观点你就会敢于表达不同的观点，因为不管你表达什么观点，你知道别人不会用一种恶意的方式来对你这个观点进行一种批判，所以就是这样会变成一种非常非常有效的产生新的观点的和思考的这样一个过程，其实是非常非常有乐趣的一个事情。那么列文森这个人本身呢，对于他来说，其实如果你去读他的著作的话，你会看到他是一个非常有思考的激情和乐趣的人。所以这个导也是，就是说我们这个工作的过程 倒也是可以说是继承了一点列文森的精神吧，就是你思考是一件很有乐趣的事情。所以我们后来呢，就是其实是会真正的在一起，找一个地方，我们都到那儿去，然后真正的坐在一起去讨论，一天里面花上8个小时，真的就是去讨论。我们在夏威夷聚过一次，然后在去澳大利亚，在悉尼聚过一次，我们还去一起去伦敦参加过一次研讨会，然后最后在为这套书做这个导读的时候，我们大家都去了 Berkeley， 那时候去了这个叶文森教授在 Berkeley 的家里面，在他家里面开了2天会，像这个澳大利亚的同事也都飞过来，蛮辛苦的。其实我个人认为这是一个非常非常好的形式，因为比如说像我做的那个摩登女郎 Modern Girl Around the World， 摩登女郎那个项目，那个是我和华大的其他几位同事一起做的，也是做了很多年。那我们几个人偏巧是在一个大学里面，我们那个书其实也是一起写的，就是也是这样子，每个人有自己的题目，但是呢定期会在一起，然后我们不管你是做哪一方面的，你是做印度史的还是德国史的还是美国史的，我们会去看每个人的那种研究素材，然后写的时候共同写的那几篇，你真的会坐在一间屋子里一句一句的这样写下来，它是一个非常耗时的事情。有的时候你如果说像自己写一篇文章的话，你要说会花10个小时做这样写这一部分的话，你可能8个人就会花80个小时。包括我们这次这个拔大概40页这样子，但是我们花的时间很多，改的那个次数我们用 Google Doc 来改，改到了最后 Google Doc 不让我改了，说你们修改的次数太多了，然后让我们重新去开始一个新的文件。那么其实就是费时间特别多，但是这也是一个思想碰撞的过程。这样生产出来的东西呢，写出来的东西，我相信它的内容和它的丰富性和它里面带有的那种内在的一种张力，应该和一个人写出来的东西是应该是有所不同的，我想。
一开始听到董老师这么去介绍列文森小组，我就马上想到京都大学霞间直树、石川正浩教授他们的研究班，那也是一个非常有成效的一种学术讨论的形式，所以我就这个问题去问了欧立德老师。
So yeah, we don't do 研究会 or 研究小组 very much in the United States. That's not how research is typically structured, unlike in Japan, where I've spent time, where there are a lot of kenkyūkai of different sorts, yanjōhui, that meet regularly to over many, many years, and produce work and bring people together from different universities. That's not so much a thing, I think. This one is very small. It's really just five or six of us. It came about partly because a number of us did our PhDs at UC Berkeley.Or with others who had done their PhDs at UC Berkeley before. So there's a kind of genealogical connection to Levinson. You know, they knew of Levinson, of course, because they had as graduate students themselves. And then, you know, trying to understand what was happening in the 2000s and in the 2010s, that they went back to Levinson and they said to themselves, that there's actually stuff here for us still.Surprisingly, given that it was written, most of those books were written in the 50s and then it finished up in the 60s. You know, there were some connections as well with scholars in China who shared some of our concerns. And so some of our meetings included those people. We had some meetings there in Suzhou, in Honolulu, at Berkeley. Why did it last so long? I think part of it is that we enjoyed each other's company. We always had interesting conversations.There always seemed to be plenty to talk about, so that when we would finish our meetings after a couple of 3 days, we would all agree that, well, there seemed to be more things here to be said, and maybe we should be writing something about this. And we did put together a panel at the Asian Studies conference in San Diego. I think that was 10 years ago now. to bring some of this up, and it attracted quite a large crowd. So that seemed to suggest to us that we were not the only ones who were interested in trying to understand how to bring Levinson forward into the 21st century to understand current developments. But, you know, we didn't have gigantic funding or anything like that. It was all small amounts of money. It was not a big project. There was no master plan. It all just kind of happened, I would say, organically. It was very Oran. 不是十五年还是十几年前有人说好我们要做一个大计划今年要在这里见面然后第二年在这边见面没有没有这个就是非常的有机的偶然的一些交谈 Happily, you know, our work coincided with stuff that you have been doing in the translation and publication of Levinson's books.
董老师和欧老师的回答都非常有意思，提供了很多丰富的细节。不过作为一个学历史的人，那我还是很想搞清楚，就是小组的起源是怎么一回事。所以这个问题我就又去问了叶文新老师，这也是董老师和欧老师的指点。他们说啊，这个问题大概只有叶老师能回答。
我想开始的时候，最开始的时候大概是期末时白杰明他们两个跑到伯克利来，可能是我们三个不晓得在什么地方吃披萨，或者是反正我记得在一个哪个树下，反正伯克利的讨论都是在树下发生的，大概不晓得坐在哪一棵树底下一块吃披萨，同时一块喝酒，从那儿说起。那为什么从那儿说起呢？期末时那个时候开始想写，就他们两个，当然白杰明跟期末时对于这个当代中国的知识现象以及学术潮流是非常的关心的。我们那个时候所共同关注到的一点呢，就是90年代两边学术交流开放之后，大家体会到一些这种知识话语上的落差。所谓知识话语上的落差是什么意思呢？最明显的譬如说，大概在70年代的晚期，80年代，这个西方的汉学界就已经把这个所谓现代化这个话语论述做了批判。那么之所以做了批判呢，是认为这个现代化这个话语论述，尤其是从经济学或者是历史哲学的角度上来看，那个里头带了太多的这个美国为本位的色彩，不足以涵盖美国以外的经验。同时那个时候呢，我们也觉得那些现代化的这个论述包含了太多的这种功能性的论述，而不能够接触到价值问题或者是文化问题，不能够掌握到一个现象的这个内在的意涵。所以我们三个在树下呢，显然是我们越说越高兴呢，那么越说越高兴之余，我们就三个就谈到列文森。因为列文森在西方学界也有很长的一段时候，我们的这个风气从我们的这个学术潮流从思想史转向社会史以及文化史，我们不做思想史了。所以呢，我们是透过跟在国内的学者的交流，认识到列文森有人读，不只是说这个现代化这个叙事有人读，而是列文森有人读，不但是有人读，而且有人觉得有意思。所以我们三个呢，开始的时候的想法是，当代的中国的学者，重要的学者，为什么要读列文森？他们看到的是什么？我们反过头去看列文森的话呢，我们那时候第一个就是好几个主要的想法。最主要的就是说，他的这种系统性的论述，以及这个把历史经验当作 理论基础的这种思维的方式，以及辩证的思维方式，很有19世纪，很有黑格尔的色彩，但是不是20世纪下半期西方汉学界，严格的来说从学术角度出发所提倡或者是所能够接受的一些论述。所以我们呢开始的时候呢是抱着这种好奇心，从这种风格上列文森跟我们的风格的差异，以及国内学者跟西方汉学界在同一个时期，就90年代以后读列文森，大家对他的这种书写风格的不同的反应。我们入手的时候是从那个地方入手的，所以我们三个觉得这个现象本身很有趣。当年是各读各的列文森，在不同的地方读的，因为我们三个的这个大学跟研究所的背景是不同的，所以我们三个各读了一套。那么我们现在凑在一块儿，我们先大家相互印证一下，就是你当年的印象是什么，你现在的印象是什么。那不过因为那个时候已经进到90年代末期21世纪的初期，所以我们还得问我们自己一个问题，就是我们干这个是值得吗？这是浪费时间吗？那显然呢，经过了这么多年呢相互讨论的结果呢，我们不认为这是浪费时间。不过开始的时候我们是存有这个疑窦的。
我想前面其实展现了一个很美妙的过程，就是你在阅读一本书的过程中，你在不断重读它的过程中，你开始慢慢的发现同伴了，你发现了小组，你发现了组织，然后大家一起往前走。其实在这之外呢，我还有一个好奇，就是除了小组成员之外，那列文森在整个北美学界甚至整个中国研究界他的阅读情况和接受情况是什么样的。请问欧老师。
I think that, you know, when I was in graduate school, everybody read Levinson still. So this is a long time ago, almost 40 years ago. And I think that over time, what's happened is that, or what started to happen, was that people knew about Levinson and they were expected to know more or less, you know, what he had written and to refer to it, but they didn't necessarily read it for themselves. They might have read other people responding to Levinson,because his influence was so great, but they didn't necessarily read it themselves. And I just, as it happens with many historians over time, you know, gradually their work tends to get read less and less. There are new books that are published, people's interests change, and the kinds of questions that the previous generation of scholars were interested in is no longer, those are no longer the questions that people continue to be interested in. So that's, you know, in part, that's kind of a natural thing. So that, although in my first years of teaching, I continued to assign Levinson, after a while, you know, there were so many other things that I thought students needed to read that I didn't keep it on the syllabus. I would talk about it and I would say, if you haven't read Levinson, you probably should. We don't have time in the class to discuss it in detail. I'm not going to assign it, but you should look at it. And maybe some people did. I suspect probably most people didn't. And so it kind of, his work, I think, faded from view there for a little while. I would say by the early 2000s, probably he was not being read all that much. Certainly, I mean, he was never somebody you would have assigned to read in an undergraduate first year course, but an upper division course or a graduate student course, you could expect to have him assigned in the, certainly in the 80s, maybe still in the early 90s, but then 10 years after that, maybe not so much.
我曾经在叶文兴老师的文章中读到您的两个比喻，一个是荒野中的大教堂，一个是家族的老相簿。 印象都很深。可不可以请您解释一下这两个比喻的意思？
The first allusion, is to the cathedral in the desert, 荒野中的大教堂。And that's pretty much what I was referring to just a moment ago, where people are aware of this amazing person, this fantastic scholar and his landmark book that for a good generation or two was something that everybody talked about and read. But that was a church that nobody went to anymore. You could admire it from a distance, but it was off far away, and you just needed to kind of nod in that direction, and that was all you did. So I think that was the result of, again, partly just the passage of time, partly the way that things had changed in terms of the field, and also changes in China, where with Gaigu Kaifeng and everything, it seemed that ideology, political ideology, revolutionary political ideology of the Maoist sort mattered less. And the kinds of things that Levinson was talking about maybe were not so relevant anymore, at least not in terms of understanding China today. They were important for understanding Chinese historiography, but not necessarily for understanding modern China. So I think that was, that idea of this work that was admired. And again, Levinson's name was known to everybody because one of the big prizes that is given for work in Chinese history by the Association for Asian Studies is the Levinson Prize. So every year people would hear Levinson's name and they would know, they would be reminded of that. But it was a name that I think especially for scholars of younger generation than mine, was a name that they respected, that they venerated, but that was not somebody that they really engaged with. So that's one allusion. Rereading him, you could see where so many later books had been inspired by the things that Levinson had written about, so that as you were reading through it, you could see his picture, and then you could see of many other people whose books kind of had their source in Levinson's work. And so I'm thinking particularly of Confucian China and its modern fate. You could see where so much of the history of the field had been kind of laid out, prefigured in a way, in Levinson's work. And you became aware of the way in which you yourself maybe were influenced without really knowing it by what you had read as a student, that it had stuck with you in ways that you were not conscious of, and then gradually worked those ideas, worked their way through in your own writing, so that there was a kind of a genealogical effect of Levinson that I think affected many of us. I'm not the only one, I think.
现在就回到一个当下的问题，就是为什么现在我们有必要去找回这座荒野大教堂？他已经去世了50年，他完全没有经受过后来的各种各样的史学潮流的这种冲洗。那他的学说在现在还有没有不可替代的意义？就是在您觉得
？I think for me anyway, there's a kind of a rediscovery in Levinson of a relevance of the questions that he was interested in that.Mattered again. This became particularly apparent to me starting maybe 10 or 12 years ago when I began to see again some of the same kinds of references to ideas that I thought had been kind of set aside by the revolution. So ideas like Tianxia, for instance, or ideas like Shengshi, different kinds of rhetoric, a return to interest in.Ideas that we would call Confucian or Confucianist types of ideas that, again, when I was a graduate student, nobody would have taken those seriously. And you know, Levinson thought that they had all been put into a museum. He tried to understand how the connection between revolutionary China and dynastic China was contributing to a new modern Chinese identity. And it became pretty clear to me anyway, and I think not only to me, again, starting about 10, 12 years ago, that that process was still going on. And that so-called Confucian China, traditional China, whatever you want to call it, had not gone away, but was in fact continued to serve as, was in fact coming back and continued to serve as a source of ideas for what the modern Chinese nation should be. And that was still having, though, to sit alongside ideas of communism and Marxism and Maoism and revolution and all of that kind of thing, class struggle and the kinds of things that in the 70s and in the 80s were certainly still front and center for many of us. So all of a sudden it seemed that Levinson was actually not so passé at all, and that the issues that he was trying to understand, this whole 从天下到国家的过程, that was the core of his concerns in Confucian China, that this guochong was still ongoing and that he had lots of still important things to say about it. Even again, some of the ways that he said them, we wouldn't say today. And you know, he had no access to archives, obviously, because the archives were not open yet when he was writing. So there are parts of his work that are dated. Still many of the same fundamental questions about the formation of the modern Chinese identity and the modern Chinese state seem quite fresh still, particularly some of the things that Levinson wanted to say about China being a special case and about exceptionalism. You know, we have a lot of in the United States as well. America also thinks of itself as being exceptional. China thinks of itself as being exceptional. Everybody wants to be an exception. You know, these are things that Levinson gave a lot of thought to, and you know, they still seem to really make sense. And the copy of Levinson that I was reading is still the same copy that I had as a graduate student. So I had my notes in it from before, and I could see what I thought about all of this back in the 1980s. And I didn't agree with all of it, but there's still a lot in there that seemed to be worth thinking about again and thinking with again, because Levinson often asked super interesting questions. He didn't always answer the questions that he asked, but he did raise the really interesting questions that I think that both Chinese and American and European intellectuals interested in China can profitably work with still today. And so I think they began to go, again, this small group of us who worked on this preface started to go back into the church, that church in the desert, spend more time there. And the addition, the fact that we now have a new Chinese translation of all of his work, I think we will see. But my guess is that there may be a renewed interest more broadly, both in China and in the West, in Levinson's ideas on this very long and ongoing transformation between China in, say, 1900 and China today.
荒野中的大教堂一直是我个人非常喜欢的一个比喻，就是你马上能看到那样一个画面，那样一个意象，一片荒地之中，当周围的一切都已经变成废墟，可是那个教堂还因为某些原因，因为某些坚守伫立在那里，静静地等待着有心人去探访。比较有趣的是，不管是欧老师还是叶文兴老师，其实都提到最近这些年慢慢开始真的有人回去探访了。
列文森在美国的学界冷门了许久，当年他在的时候虽然是非常的重要，可是呢他过世的很早。那么他过世了之后呢，有两个原因让大家不大愿意再提他。一个原因呢，就是他那个 莫扎特式的史家，那本书就是史家里的莫扎特，那本书出了之后呢，他的这个亲朋故旧，大致上说起来就是等于是把这个事情结束了。那么结束了之后呢，我想总体说来有两个理由，大家就不大再提他。一个呢是因为他的书呢不是很容易读的，就是不能够随便引来信手拈来说如此这般就可以这个不言而喻，可以说出道理来。那么他因为他难引，而且你说他的这个总的论述是什么，这不是三言两语说得清楚的，所以这是一个，所以因为他难。另外还有一个呢，就是我想后来大家做这个文化史跟社会史，那么还有吗，就是说政治制度方面的研究，这些东西研究的成果都跟他的内涵有些关系，可是最后做出不同的结论，跟他渐行渐远之后，反而不愿意回过头来谈列文森，因为呢，正是因为他英年早逝，所以大家对于批评他这回事，大家去保存几分这种肃穆的心，就是提到他的时候，所以这人不是一个，如果他今天还在，或者是如果他高寿，那么后来跟他当面辩难的人一定很多。可是正因为他英年早逝，同时呢，那情况也非常的突然，那么大家，他人缘又是非常的好，所以大家提到他的名字的时候有一种肃穆的心。所以到后来呢，列文森在研究所的书目里头，据我所知使用的时候并不是很多。譬如说在伯克利，我们考这个博士考试，考博士考试的时候列文森很少，就是过去的二三十年列文森很少在书目上。可是呢，最近的几年情况有所改变，就最新一代年轻的学者他们又开始读列文森。那么这个不是哪位教授让他们读的，而是他们自己这个按图索骥找到他那儿，觉得他有意思。那么当他们读了列文森以后，他们有些人呢来找我谈列文森，开口的第一句话也是列文森很难读，我们不知道他在说什么。所以总的说起来，就是说列文森在美国汉学界其实是冷门了很多年。
列文森固然在去世之后被冷落了很长一段时间，在他生前其实他的学说也并不是马上就得到巨大的认可和接受，他也遭受过不少的批评。周希瑞老师的访谈中提到一点这方面的情况，但是周老师也提醒我们在读列文森的书的时候要留意真正重要的东西是什么。
You read Xiaobo Chen is one of the examples who wrote about Kanye Wei. Levinson doesn't even appear in his bibliography and is never even cited in the book. Zhang Hao mentions him, butvery briefly and indirectly. There undoubtedly were places where Levinson just didn't quite understand the intricacies of Wuja Sixian, of Confucianism. I'm sure he made mistakes. And to many of his Chinese readers,these mistakes were inexcusable, and enough to disqualify him. I don't have to talk about it. And I believe that was Xiaobo Chen's. I won't speak for Zhang Hao. He can speak for himself. Their view. This is an outsider, a foreigner. He just doesn't understand. But I still think that coming from a deep understanding of Western intellectual tradition and coming from his own Jewish identity, and people have mentioned this before, but I think it's extremely important. China in the late Qing and early Republic had an identity as a culture. You were Chinese because you read certain classics and you absorbed certain customs and so on. And that's very much like Jewish identity. I mean, there was no nation, but China became a nation. And I think there's an element of Levinson's appreciation of identity as a Jew and the pre-national identity of China as Chinese that made a good deal of sense. And he appreciated some things that perhaps maybe even modern Chinese, more nationalist scholars didn't quite appreciate. I'm particularly grateful that the Chinese University of Hong Kong Press has created a Chinese edition of Levinson. I haven't read it yet, so how you actually translated this not easy, very difficult English, and the deep appreciation of the Western culture that is embodied in it. And I think a very useful interpretation of Chinese intellectual history.
周老师说的没错，这套书确实是太难太难了。我第一次直面文本的时候真的是有当头一棒的感觉。可是呢，跟董老师的感觉有点接近哈，就是你遭受了最初的困惑之后呢，你还是会时不时想起它，你会在想，就是这样一种高浓度的思考之下，这样一种不明觉厉之下，是不是掩盖了一些我们以往忽视但是具有很大意义的东西。那我自己的表达能力有限，我请几位老师为中文世界的读者提供一点建议，就是要怎么去读列文森，要做好怎么样的思想上的、心理上的、知识上的准备，或者说其实准备了也没什么用。那还是先请周希瑞老师。
If this is introduced to a Chinese audience so that there will be some appreciation of Levinson, and I hope people will not just say, oh, he's got this wrong, he's got that wrong, he made a mistake here, he made a mistake there, but actually try to grasp what he's trying to do, I think you will have done an enormous contribution. The corpus, and I think the problem that Levinson was trying to deal with, was how did a nation which defined itself in terms of its culture come to redefine itself in terms of a nation? Now, in Levinson's time, and I think he was very much influenced throughout his thinking by Liang Qichao and then the May 4th movement. That meant that to be a modern nation, you had to reject the Confucian past. I think the problem that I would like Chinese readers to think about now is in a new age in which Chinese are asked to appreciate the Chinese tradition and see the nation as the final product of that tradition and the realization of the characters of that tradition. how that is a very different problem from the problem that Levinson was trying to deal with and that the early 20th century figures were trying to deal with. How is one to read Levinson in that context? At a time when you talk about Zhonghua Minzu De Fuxing and New Confucianism and so on, how does that fit with Levinson? Levinson talked about the museumification of Confucianism, thought that you could safely put Confucius in a museum. Well, Confucius is out of the museum now. It's a very different world. So how does one deal with that Levinson problem? How does one read him today? I think that's a problem that has got to be relevant to Chinese reader.
叶老师，您觉得呢？
就是现在是完全事过境迁。所谓事过境迁有好几个意思。冷战已经结束，我们这个大陆跟西方的学界现在有一种学术上交流的一个网络。那么同时呢，列文森的著作就是他的学术分析，无论分析个人或者是一个问题，他都对这个主体所处的时间跟空间有高度的敏感性。那么他所做的文章往往是在这种时空变化的环境里面，这个主体在经历上有所破裂或者是有所断裂，因此产生新的命题。他往往做文章，他的分析的方式往往是这样的。那么我们今天回过头来看的话呢，他的这个方式有极大的意义，但是他所认定的一些叙事，譬如说他以晚清作为背景，他首先指出的一个最基本的一个现象，就是晚清的中国知识界丧失文化自信。那么这话呢，说在1890年或者是1900年可以成立，可是这话搬到100年之后就未必。那所以他的一些，从这个意义上来说，他的描述的方式或者是分析的方式是继续有意义的，可是他的基本的对于在地情况的描述是需要修正的。所以总的说起来呢是这样，对不对？因为从今天100年以后倒回头去看，列文森最基本的观察之一就是对于这个晚清以及民国初年启蒙的一代的一些观察，他最基本的认定是这个文化在传承里头因为遭遇到断裂，所以有一整代的知识人对中国的传统丧失自信，所以后面的这个整个的中国近代思想史这个内源的这个张力是从这个断裂而来的。那他也同时认为，没有断裂，没有张力，就其实就没有现代性。因为他并不完全认为这个断裂跟张力是独属于中国的，是吧？就是传统与近现代的转化之间，这个断裂跟这种失态或者是错位的感觉，这是近代化或者是现代化内涵的特质。如果没有这种错位的感觉、断裂的感觉或者是失落 之后的重新的寻找，那么那个历史呢本身呢，尤其是从文化思想的角度上来看，缺乏内源的动力。那他这话说的也是对不对？因为我们回过头去看的话呢，就是往往在这个知识领域里头，大家都觉得非常的饱满，这个四平八稳啊，在那个情况之下呢，就想不出什么新的点子来。
欧老师，您对中文世界的读者有什么样的建议呢？
他不是很容易读懂的人，他的写法很复杂很繁复，他不是很写得很直的一个人，所以你要准备要花一点时间习惯他的那种文笔，他的那个 style。 要是你有一些地方你觉得难懂，这不是因为翻译的问题，因为我相信这次翻译翻得很好，这就是他本来就是不容易懂，就是我们研究生的时候读他也不见得第一次读都一定都读懂的，读一段休息然后回来再读再考虑，这不是 fast food， 这不是 intellectual 的 fast food， 这是一个 很丰富 的一个大宴嘛，一个 banquet， 要慢慢慢慢来，慢慢吃，慢慢欣赏，这可能是会是一种阅读 Levinson 的一种策略吧。
董老师，作为列文森文集的主编，通过这套文集，您希望向中文的思想界传达什么样的信息呢？
一个呢，就是希望能够为中国学者学术史本身，希望有一个更完整、更动态的一个理解。你要看到，就是在西方这个领域的发展，它是一个彼此挑战、彼此激荡这样一个过程，包括列文森和费正清。像我自己对于他们之间的，不管是个人还是说他们的学术倾向和他们的思想倾向上的理解，以前有一些东西其实也是有误解的。那么在这个过程当中，我其实对这个问题有一些新的理解。所以就是说，以前在比如说在中国国内的话，对于费正清讲的比较多，对于列文森基本上是没有的。那么首先就是说，希望这个能够帮助中国学界对于这个历史学术史本身有一个更准确和更大范围的理解。第二呢，我觉得列文森虽然说他是几十年前的一位学者，他去世的太早了，就是学术领域的这个领域的一个巨大的很悲哀的事情，很大的一个遗憾。但是呢，列文森我一直认为他是一个超前的学者，像他提出的那些问题，在当时的学界，无论是西方学界还是关于中国的研究的这个学界，都是在80年代、90年代以后才成为很热的题目。那他在50、60年代的时候其实就是在讲这些，所以他是一个超前的学者。那么在一个很具体的意义上来讲，列文森最大的梦想就是他坚信中国无论以怎样的形式，最后还是会成为世界的一部分。那么我觉得我们处在一个历史时刻，在今天中国真的是世界的一部分，但是这个问题就是中国应该以怎样的形象和方式重新成为世界的一部分。那我觉得在这个时候把列文森的思考介绍给整体的系统的介绍给中国读者，至少是介绍一种方式，因为它非常的与众不同，它不是说用中国去验证西方的一种理论，也不是简单的把中国的历史和西方的历史进行一种比较。他自己，列文森让我印象非常深刻的一点，就是他在方法论上保持了一种非常高度的一致性，自觉的意识和高度的一致性。怎么讲呢？比如说他在他所有的著作当中，他强调说你可以有类比，而且你应该类比，但是你首先要开创这个可比性，你为什么要比 你在什么意义上在比较这两个社会，这两个历史，然后比较的结果一定不是类同，而是差异。像他的那本教科书《诠释中国史》这本小书，为什么要把它翻译过来？因为我读过以后的感觉是，那本书里面在方法论这个意义上，其实作为一个解释列文森的方法论，比其他的可能要更明晰。比如说他关于封建这个词，那么在中国的自己的历史叙述当中，用封建这个词用的是很多的。他从这一个共同的概念开始，然后去看世界上很多地方不同的体制，最后你从一个相同的概念开始得到的是，最后是一个对于每个社会不同的非常深刻的理解。所以这个是，就是说他在看中国怎样属于世界这样一个方法论上，我觉得是有值得我们借鉴的地方。那么还有就是他是对这个事情是充满激情与信心的，就是中国一定会重新成为世界的一部分。而他呢，相信坚信说历史学家历史学应该在这个过程当中起到一个非常重要的作用，因为书写历史的过程本身就是一个行动的过程，也就是一个创造历史的过程。那么你在书写历史的时候，他像他这样的博大精深不是我们每个人都能够学得到做得到的，但是呢也不是说我们不能够努力。我们在写历史的时候，我们是出发点就是想要强调说我写这个历史跟别人都一点关系都没有，还是说我思考这个问题它跟别人是有关联的，这个就是说它会造成一个非常大的不同。在他看来，这个世界上不管你是哪一个文明，哪一个社会，哪一个国家，在经历过一个世界共同的这样一个现代性的世界历史这个过程当中，你有同样的问题。所以呢，他是从同样的问题开始。比如说他并不是要去验证韦伯的理论，但是呢他在中国的历史当中看到了韦伯在欧洲研究的那些问题。其实他并不支持韦伯的理论，他曾经写过关于韦伯的书的书评，那是充满了批评的，他认为韦伯真的不懂中国。但是呢并不妨碍他去在中国的历史当中看到韦伯所看到的问题。那么这个其实是有一个很大的差别的。所以就是我觉得列文森呢，他最大的梦想就是他希望能够看到中国重新回到世界。那么他研究的是中国能够或者应该可以以怎样的方式重新回到世界。那我觉得此刻在今天的这个世界上，在应该说在这个世界的联系其实是越来越紧密的时刻，我们也会发现分裂性的东西却也越来越多。那么在这个时候，我觉得列文森的这种精神和他的这种作为历史学的一种方法，和他的这样一种信心，和他这样一种期待，我觉得应该对于我们来说是一种非常具有启发性和激励性的东西。在这个意义上，我希望这套书能够让中国读者，中文的读者能够从中得到某些有益处的东西吧。